Today is Tuesday, June 8th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden readies for summit with President Putin.
Joe Biden is not meeting with Vladimir Putin despite our country's differences. He's meeting with him because of our country's differences.
Plus, Tigray fighting takes heavy toll on children.
The Ethiopian government says it takes very seriously its responsibility to alleviate the suffering of the people in the Tigray region.
Also, ILO discusses global COVID job losses. Our top story today is in the U.S. President Joe Biden's planned meeting with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin is not a, quote, reward, unquote, for Putin, but instead the most effective way to hear directly from him to understand and manage the differences between Washington and Moscow, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said on Monday. In a briefing, Sullivan told reporters that Biden would also stress the importance of NATO countries' burden sharing and the need for allies to give contributions to alliance exercises and operations. He added that the United States will respond if Russia's, quote, harmful, unquote, activities against Washington continue.
We do not regard a meeting with the Russian president as a reward. We regard it as a vital part of defending America's interests and America's values. Joe Biden is not meeting with Vladimir Putin despite our country's differences. He's meeting with him because of our country's differences. There is simply a lot we have to work through. We believe that President Biden is the most effective direct communicator of American values and priorities, and we believe that hearing directly from President Putin is the most effective way to understand what Russia intends and plans. There is never any substitute for leader-to-leader engagement, particularly for complex relationships, but with Putin, this is exponentially the case. He has a highly personalized style of decision-making, and so it is important for President Biden to be able to sit down with him face-to-face to be clear about where we are, to understand where he is, to try to manage our differences, and to identify those areas where we can work in America's interests to make progress.
That's White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Environmentalists for decades have had mixed feelings about nuclear power. Now, U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has decided to cautiously embrace the energy resource, despite lingering safety concerns, to help achieve its goal of a net-zero carbon economy for America by the year 2050. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports from the North End Power Station in Mineral, Virginia.
This nuclear power plant, with a pair of decades-old pressurized water reactors, produces about 20% of the state of Virginia's electricity. The nearly 100 nuclear reactors across the United States will be absolutely essential for the country to meet the goals President Joe Biden has set for greenhouse gas emissions, according to his climate advisor, Gina McCarthy.
Now, I don't expect those old ones to be around a long time, but I do expect them to be safe, and I expect them to continue in a way that's going to allow us to keep the greenhouse gas emissions down with really stable baseload capacity.
Aside from reliability, nuclear power production is relatively compact. The equivalent of a 1 gigawatt reactor would require numerous solar panels or wind turbines, blanketing an area several hundred times bigger than what is needed for a typical nuclear power plant. Dan Stoddard is Dominion Energy's chief nuclear officer.
There's not a sufficient recognition of nuclear as being carbon free. So I think that's in part on us as an industry to better communicate that fact. We have a great story to tell in nuclear.
For decades, environmental groups warned about the risks of nuclear power, pointing to accidents at Three Mile Island in the United States, Chernobyl in Ukraine, and Fukushima in Japan. They also raised concerns about where and how to safely store radioactive waste for the long term. Greenpeace, once on the forefront of this, no longer actively campaigns against nuclear power in the United States. The group declined VOA's request for an on-camera interview on the topic, but it did send a statement arguing nuclear energy is both expensive and dangerous, and just because nuclear pollution is invisible doesn't mean it's clean. The group suggests that instead of pouring money into new nukes, the Biden administration should focus on phasing out fossil fuels and investing in the transition to a renewable energy economy. The nuclear industry calls that outdated thinking.
These plants, approaching 50 years of operation, have never operated more safely or more reliably in their history. The United States nuclear industry has an incredible track record of safe and reliable operation.
Nuclear plants like this one remain the country's top source of emissions-free power generation, but they were not designed to last forever, and very few new ones are being built in the United States. Decommissioning too many of them could send Biden's clean energy goals up in smoke. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the North Anna Power Station in Mineral, Virginia.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited the U.S. Pentagon on Monday to meet with U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. During a press briefing, Stoltenberg discussed the challenges facing not only NATO but the world. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon has been following the Secretary General's visit. He began a conversation with International Edition Steve Miller by providing an update on NATO's withdrawal from Afghanistan.
The Secretary General said that the withdrawal is on track for the early September deadline, which is similar to what we've heard from Pentagon officials as well, who have said that the U.S. portion of the withdrawal is almost 50% complete, and there have been hints that the U.S. could be completely out of Afghanistan much sooner than the September 11th deadline that was set by President Joe Biden. The focus for NATO's part of the withdrawal, though, has been on the safety of the security of its forces as they leave. That has also been on track and so far not been a problem. The interesting thing is that the Secretary General said that with all of this, there is a risk. Withdrawing from Afghanistan entails risk, that there's uncertainty. And of course, there's been a lot of concern voiced by critics, both on the right and the left, of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, that it's going to leave the Afghan government in an indefensible position where it and its security forces could potentially fall to the Taliban.
The Secretary General also said that the global balance of power is shifting with the rise of China and that NATO sees Russia continuing to be responsible for aggressive actions against NATO itself and its allies. What more did the Secretary General have to say?
This is a theme that Jens Stoltenberg has been echoing time and time again over the last several weeks and even going back further about where NATO has to go in order to continue to be an effective alliance. He talks about it as part of the NATO 2030 plan that he's been pitching and that will come up for discussion when NATO leaders meet next week. And a lot of that has to do with, in his words, turning NATO not just into a military alliance, but as a political platform to counter some of what Russia and some of what China are doing in terms of trying to shift the balance of power for the world. And so he's been promoting a need for NATO to come together and push back against that. And that means being not just a military alliance, standing up to Russian aggression and Russian malign activity, as he pointed to in Ukraine.
That's Jeff Seldon, VOA's national security correspondent, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. Since the brutal civil war in Ethiopia's Tigray region began in November, many healthcare centers in the area have been looted and destroyed. Parents often have to travel for weeks to get care for children injured in battles. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Mekelle and Adaga Hamus in Ethiopia.
Some of the children in this hospital ward traveled for weeks to get here after being shot, knifed, or hit by shrapnel in the ongoing war in Ethiopia's Tigray region. 15-year-old Bariha Gebrey has lost one eye and is permanently blind in the other.
She and her cousin went out to play in the yard. Suddenly, they saw people running. They also ran, and they were both shot.
It took Gebrey weeks to get to this hospital in the regional capital, Makala, as they traveled from town to town, trying to find a clinic to treat her. He says everywhere he went, he found health centers destroyed and looted. After the fighting stopped, the nurse for this clinic in Etega Hamas returned to find a burnt-out tank, bullet-riddled signs, and dead soldiers on the streets. Like so many others, her clinic was empty.
Yes, I came and the door is opened, the glass are broken, and the equipment are stolen. Nothing here.
Patients, including children and victims of rape, still come to her with war injuries. But there is very little she can do.
Emergency medicines were there. It was stolen, and some is here. Infusions and dressing, suturing, all the equipment are stolen here.
Tefatowicz says she refers patients to the few hospitals in the main cities where medical workers say they are short of supplies in every department. In the Eider Hospital in Mekelle, some children say losing their limbs has been less painful than losing their loved ones.
My older brother was with me. He was injured and died.
The Ethiopian government says it takes very seriously its responsibility to alleviate the suffering of the people in the Tigray region. The government blames the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front for the war that began last November after a coordinated attack on its forces in the region. But many people in Tigray say the region is under attack from federal forces, Eritrean forces, and Amhara militias. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Mekelle and Etega Hamas, Ethiopia.
This is the Voice of America. Numerous websites were unavailable on Tuesday after an apparent widespread outage at cloud service company Fastly. Dozens of high-traffic websites, including the New York Times, CNN, Twitch, and the UK government's homepage, could not be reached. Fastly said in repeated updates on its website that it was, quote, continuing to investigate the issue, unquote. About an hour later, the company said, quote, the issue has been identified and a fix has been applied, unquote. Customers may experience increased origin load as global services return. A number of sites that were hit early appear to be coming back online. Police in London, Ontario, says a driver plowed a pickup truck into a family of five, killing four of them and seriously injuring the other in a deliberate attack that targeted the victims because they were Muslims. Authorities say a young man was arrested in the parking lot of a nearby mall after the incident Sunday night. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un presented economic plans to senior ruling party officials before an upcoming meeting to renew efforts to overcome hardships brought about by the pandemic. State media said Kim held his consultations in preparation for a meeting of the Workers' Party's powerful Central Committee to discuss state affairs for the year so far. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A promise Monday by Mali's new interim president to hold democratic elections by early next year appears to meet some conditions set by France to resume recently suspended cooperation with Malian forces. But some hope Paris is slowly heading for the exit when it comes to its year-long Barkhane anti-terrorist operation in the Sahel. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
France's announcement last week that it was halting counterinsurgency cooperation with Malian forces followed Mali's second coup in less than a year. President Emmanuel Macron denounced the power grab as unacceptable, warning also that he would pull French troops from Mali altogether if it tipped to radical Islam. Sworn in as Mali's latest interim president days later, junta leader Assimi Goïta vowed to preserve his country's democratic gains and meet promises to hold elections by next February. Not everyone believes him.
I think that Asim Goïta is trying to reassure the international public opinion and international partners. But in the meantime, since the first transition, we see that the military try to keep themselves in power. And the last coup is an illustration of this voluntary to stay in power.
Bakary Sambe is director of the Timbuktu Institute Research Group. He says while Goïta and his military junta are under pressure, so too is Macron, as he eyes next year's presidential elections at home and sharpens his anti-terrorism rhetoric. Support for keeping France's 8-year-old 5,100-man Barkhane anti-terrorism operation in the Sahel is fading, both in France and in the countries where it operates, as anti-French sentiment is mounting. Meanwhile, Sambe says some Malians support Goïta and the idea of holding talks with at least some armed groups in the country, which France rejects.
Venturing sanctions against the junta will be perceived as a double punishment against the Malian, who already doubt the effectiveness of the action of the international community, which has neither defeated terrorism nor stabilized Mali.
Meanwhile, here in France, some hope the suspension of cooperation with Mali's army will be the first step to a bigger drawdown and eventual French military exit from the Sahel, a vast area edging the Sahara Desert that is rife with instability. Others say they aren't so sure that will happen. French anti-terrorism specialist Marc-Antoine Perrouse de Monclos says no other forces in the region can take France's place. Meanwhile, he told France's TV5 Monde channel that militants are profiting from the security void. And he notes Mali isn't France's only partner in the Sahel counterinsurgency effort. A broader so-called G5 coalition also includes Mauritania, Chad, Niger, and Burkina Faso. A case in point is Burkina Faso, where suspected Islamist militants killed at least 160 people early Saturday. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian heads to Ouagadougou this week to show France's solidarity, illustrating the bigger ties binding France to a complicated conflict. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Negotiating solutions to the global work crisis triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic will be at the center of discussions at the International Labour Conference over the next 2 weeks. Some 4,700 delegates from 176 countries have registered to attend this conference, held virtually for the first time because of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
During his opening remarks, Director General of the International Labour Organization, Guy Ryder, told his largely invisible audience that global action was required to overcome what he called the cataclysmic impact of COVID-19 on the world of work. He said this work crisis was four times as severe as the one triggered by the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. He said 255 million full-time jobs had been lost last year because of the pandemic, wiping out $3.7 trillion of labor income.
108 million people pushed back into working poverty, and the most vulnerable and already disadvantaged hit hardest. Young people, women, informal workers, migrants. The pandemic has confronted us with unbearable brutality, with the reality and consequences of the multiple and growing inequalities in our societies.
Ryder notes the pandemic has worsened the inequalities that already existed. He said they have hardened into deep structural injustice, widening the fairness gap between the rich and poor countries. He said all societies have suffered unbearable loss in health and wealth. But he said recovery from the pandemic was now underway in wealthy countries that have access to life-saving vaccines. These countries, he added, can look forward to getting back quite rapidly to pre-pandemic levels of GDP.
But for low-income countries and most of the developing world, the prospects are starkly different. The fact is that gross inequities in vaccine distribution and vastly different fiscal firepower would inject a double dose of more inequality into the world of work, with a booster from uneven digital connectivity. That is, unless deliberate action is taken to prevent it.
ILO Chief Ryder noted this terrible global crisis required a global response. He said only effective international cooperation and action can close the growing divide between the have and have-not countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Law enforcement officials in Australia say worldwide raids against organized criminal gangs have resulted in hundreds of arrests. After a three-year inquiry using an app designed by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. agency and Europol, the European Union's law enforcement body, will present their findings on Tuesday. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Suspected members of drug trafficking gangs have been arrested in 18 countries across Asia, North and South America, Europe and the Middle East. Australia was one of the first jurisdictions to reveal the sting, codenamed Operation Ironside, on Tuesday. Police there said they disrupted drug-running operations and prevented mass shootings, including a plot to attack a cafe with a machine gun. More than 200 people have been detained in raids across the country by 4,000 police officers. Large amounts of drugs, cash and some weapons were seized in an investigative operation named Operation Ironside. Australian Federal Police Commissioner Rhys Kershaw.
We allege they are members of outlaw motorcycle gangs, Australian mafia, Asian crime syndicates and serious and organised crime groups. We allege they have been trafficking illicit drugs into Australia at an industrial scale. Sadly, criminal gangs are targeting Australia because it is one of the most profitable countries in the world to sell drugs.
Since 2018, authorities in Australia, New Zealand and the United States have used an encrypted app known as Anom to track organised crime. The technology was designed by the FBI. Undercover agents distributed devices with the application to criminals, who then passed it on to their underworld associates. It allowed investigators to read millions of messages that described alleged murder plots, mass drug import plans, and other schemes. 35 people were detained in New Zealand. Australian authorities say their crime-busting raids were the nation's largest police operation. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says it's been a real success.
Operation Ironside has now charged hundreds of alleged offenders, seized millions of dollars in criminal proceeds, removed weapons from our streets and saved lives, and will continue to. It is an ongoing operation.
Australian investigators say that while the raids were successful, they were just the beginning and that efforts to combat criminal gangs would continue. They did caution, however, that while individuals and syndicates involved in alleged crime had been apprehended, there would always be someone else wanting to replace them in the illicit drug trade. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The Food and Drug Administration approved the first new drug for Alzheimer's disease in nearly 20 years. The AP's Ed Donoghue reports there were some doubts.
The drug is from Biogen.
Aducanumab, which is now going to be marketed as Aduhelm.
The FDA approved the drug, saying it was based on results that seemed reasonably likely to benefit Alzheimer's patients. Dr. Maria Carrillo is chief science officer with the Alzheimer's Association.
This therapy slows the progression of the disease because it addresses the underlying biology, one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's, which is amyloid plaques.
Therapy usually manages symptoms of Alzheimer's, like insomnia or anxiety. FDA advisor Dr. Caleb Alexander said no to the drug's approval. He said the agency has regulatory standards based on evidence, but in this case, he thinks the product got a pass. Ed Donoghue, Washington.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.